I think it's clear that it has had a significant effect holding up the Alaska economy.
Assessing the impact of the stimulus 1 year later from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 25th of February. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, reinventing what a nursing home should look like in Seward.
When we built it, we had to keep stopping and saying, would we have this in our own home?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by AT&T Wireless, your world close at hand, offering business and personal packages for South Central Alaska, 561-1122.
Alaskans have gotten more of the federal stimulus dollars per person than any other state. This month marked 1 year since President Obama signed the stimulus law, or American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, but Alaska will reap the bulk of benefits in the year ahead, APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The stimulus funds in Alaska amount to more than $2,300 per person, but Alaskans haven't necessarily seen its impact in daily life. Scott Goldsmith is an economist at ICER, the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
In most people's minds, you know, they don't identify a particular project with stimulus funds as opposed to other funds. But there are a few examples here in Alaska where it is pretty obvious.
Goldsmith points to a new hospital being built in Barrow and one in Nome, which is considered a national stimulus success story.
It has made a huge difference.
Carol Piscoya is president of the Norton Sound Health Corporation, which is building the Nome Hospital. They'd gotten funding in drips and dribbles, $10 million at a time, allowing the project to crawl forward. Then the stimulus landed them $150 million.
If we didn't get the stimulus money, we probably would get enough money to do framing. And then the next step, and maybe do the outside in the next step. So it'd be years down the road before we actually were able to move in.
And here's what the stimulus is supposed to do, ripple out. A steel company in Montana scored the Nome contract. Allied Steel's Vice President Jeff Southworth says fabricating 2,000 tons of steel kept his company from dire straits.
Because of the timing of the job, it was a huge breath of fresh air. We just weren't seeing a lot of quality projects or substantial projects. So we had some work, but we had a glaring hole, and the Nome job took away the hole.
Southworth says the work buoyed not only their community of Lewiston, but all of central Montana. And then there were trucks put to work shipping nearly 100 loads of steel to Seattle and barges that carried it to Nome. And Norton Sound Health Corporation's Carol Piscoya says the stimulus effect continues. Alaskans will go to work building the hospital in March, and eventually orders will go out for things like medical equipment.
We will be dealing directly with manufacturers in the United States, so we know that additional folks will be put to work based on that.
Economist Scott Goldsmith says the two biggest places Alaskans will feel the impact of funds are in the construction industry and education.
I think it's clear that it has had a significant effect holding up the Alaska economy, both because there are construction projects now going on that wouldn't otherwise be happening, and that's creating construction jobs and then spin-off jobs as well. But also, when you spend money in the education budget to put more people to work, that puts more people to work.
The Alaska Department of Transportation spokesman Roger Weatherall says stimulus funds will be spent throughout the state this year.
Anchorage, Fairbanks, Mat-Su, Burrow, Dillingham, the Denali Highway near Paxson, Nome, Tok, Ketchikan, Hoonah, Haines.
Weatherall says more Alaskans will feel the effects.
There's a lot of work out there, and you know, we're going to keep pressing forward and keep the employment situation in Alaska stimulated.
School districts in the state are buying new computers, training teachers, and repairing buildings. Anchorage School Superintendent Carol Como.
One of the things that I'm very excited about that is showing really good success is the 7th and 8th grade career guides that we've hired. It helps us help young people focus earlier on the importance of staying in school, getting that high school diploma, but also taking more rigorous courses.
Como remembers a year ago fighting with then-Governor Sarah Palin to accept the money, and Alaska did take it, even millions in energy grants Palin initially rejected. So a year into the stimulus, what does now Governor Sean Parnell have to say?
Short-term gain, long-term pain would describe it right now. So short-term gain, meaning that we've used stimulus funds to repair roads, to weatherize homes. I think that's been positive. My concern long run really has to do with the overall stimulus package, which has taken us into a deep deficit.
Governor Parnell isn't alone in worrying about the debt, but economist Scott Goldsmith believes that should be dealt with later, once the economy has recovered.
People are concerned about the debt, certainly. I actually think that's a little misguided at this point in time, because the reason we're taking on some debt in the short term is to be able to put people to work. You know, what's the alternative?
A year from now, Alaskans may be able to more easily point out stimulus money projects. In 2009, the state received less than a quarter of its allotted $1.5 billion, meaning there's a lot more yet to come. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Attorney General designee Dan Sullivan today was warmly received by the House Judiciary Committee in the first step along the way to his final confirmation. Sullivan was appointed by former Governor Sarah Palin last June and has been serving in the office since then. A large part of the meeting focused on his aggressive role in Governor Sean Parnell's fight against the federal government's involvement in Alaska affairs. Sullivan said the federal government is overreaching and using Alaska as an example.
This state seems to be in the bullseye no matter what with regard to that overreach. It's the default state that the feds love to come at.
Sullivan told the committee he is approaching the fight from several points. First, he's trying to intervene in as many lawsuits as possible to get the state involved in the issues and in any settlement talks. He's also working with multiple sources within the Obama administration to make sure Alaska's arguments are available when decisions are made. But his biggest effort is in working with other states to warn them of the consequences of federal actions. He sent a letter this week to all other attorneys general, and he will speak to a conference next week. He said he has one message.
Look, here's our problems on this. You might think that this is Alaska problem, but trust me, this is coming to a theater near you in a very short time.
You're here.
And you're going to need to react. So we need to react together. And I don't think this is a Democrat or Republican issue. I just think it's an issue that a lot of the states are feeling.
The letter refers to the use of the Endangered Species Act to protect habitat that is affected by global climate change. The committee voted unanimously to forward Sullivan's name to the full legislature for confirmation shortly before the end of the session. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, finding solutions to the air quality problem in Fairbanks.
This department receives hundreds of phone calls every year from individuals that are literally being smoked out of their house.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
The Fairbanks Borough Assembly is considering measures aimed at cleaning up local air. Two ordinances on the Assembly's agenda tonight target fine particulate pollution from wood burning. They include everything from a public education campaign to an old stove changeout program to fines for chronic polluters. Glenn Miller, who heads up air quality control for the borough, says the ordinances focus on wood smoke because it's been identified as a primary source of particulates and generates a lot of complaints.
We really need to do something to ensure that the population is protected from egregious violations. But at the same time, we have to be able to help people heat their homes in an affordable manner. And this is a good start.
The borough regularly violates federal standards for fine particulates when cold air inversions trap pollution at ground level. The Environmental Protection Agency has designated part of the borough as a non-attainment area. The borough has until December 2012 to come up with a compliance plan and another 2 years to fulfill it. Miller says the first ordinance, which is set up for vote tonight, provides for spending $300,000 in grant money on public education and outreach.
We've talked about trying to get real-time data available to the public, and that means equipment at our monitoring sites, more monitoring sites with real-time data, so we're not just reporting at one area. We've also talked about employing some type of signage along the roads that are real-time, so as people drive by, they can actually see what the air quality data is in their particular areas. Also, campaigns on how to burn wood properly and the benefits of burning dry wood.
Miller says the borough is looking at access to burn areas, kilns, and wood banks as means to improving the local supply of dry firewood. The second ordinance, which is only being introduced tonight, includes the old stove removal or replacement program. It taps $1 million in federal economic stimulus money as well as property tax credits to ease the cost burden for homeowners. Borough residents would have until September 2011 to convert. Miller says after that date, the ordinance empowers the borough to fine chronic polluters.
This department receives hundreds of phone calls every year from individuals that are literally being smoked out of their house, and they're wondering what we can do about it. And right now, there really isn't anything that we can do about it. So this ordinance also provides for a mechanism to deal with nuisances or egregious violators that are, in fact, smoking out their neighbors and really affecting the quality of their life.
Pollution fines outlined in the proposed ordinance range from $300 to $500. Miller says it's never popular to impose restrictions on the public and anticipates a lot of feedback. He says that cracking down on wood smoke pollution is only the first step in tackling Fairbanks's particulate problem. He says emissions from heating oil, motor fuels, and coal burnings are still being studied and will be addressed with future measures. A new nursing home in Seward may help reinvent the model for caring for the elderly. Seward Mountain Haven was designed to get rid of the institutional feel of most traditional long-term care facilities. It's called a greenhouse, and it's a concept that's catching on around the country. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The old Seward nursing home looked like a watered-down hospital. It had long, stark hallways, double occupancy rooms, and an institutional-style kitchen. Long-term care administrator Kathy Kloster was pretty sure there was a better way, but she didn't know what that was until she heard a presentation at a conference in Texas several years ago.
Well, an hour into the class, we're all tears are rolling down our face because we realized what we had been doing to our elders. You know, the only what the woman said at that class was the only two people that are two classes of people that we continue to institutionalize are criminals and elders. So we left there saying this is what we have to do.
That class was on the greenhouse model. The simple idea is to build nursing homes that look and feel as much like real homes as possible. Residents moved into the Seward greenhouses last October, a campus with four homes that have 10 bedrooms each. There are no hallways. Instead, the rooms surround a central area where there's recliners, a long table for dining, and a big open kitchen. Kloster says even small details matter, like getting rid of the institutional-style medication carts.
When we built it, we had to keep stopping and saying, would we have this in our own home? Is this how we would do this in our own home? Would we have these things in our own home? No. And so why can't the elders? Why do the elders have to have such institutional-looking stuff in their homes?
The greenhouse is an entire culture shift, too. At one of the Seward homes, worker Rainey Albino is sautéing a mix of zucchini and peppers for the day's lunch. At the old facility, Albino was strictly a cook, But here, she's one of several Shabazim, basically a family member to the elders. Besides cooking, she helps them with daily tasks and does light housekeeping.
It's different, definitely different. You do a little bit of everything, so you got to multitask, that's for sure. So,
do you like it?
Yeah, it's been taking some getting used to. I mean, I originally cooked, and that's what I went to school for and everything like that, so it's kind of a whole new world for me.
It's a whole new world for the elders, too, but one they seem to enjoy. A resident named Linda has a long list of things she loves about her new home. Her spacious room, having her own shower, and...
We have a huge pantry. Did you show her the pantry? Show her the pantry. we have a pantry with everything in the world in it. And I just like to go back there and piddle around. And
Linda also likes the home-cooked meals and the Shabazim.
It's like I have a family here, and I really enjoy that. We laugh and watch TV and just enjoy being here. We're going to plant some flowers when the spring comes. Maybe even some strawberries.
Greenhouses are popping up around the country, but Seward's Mountain Haven is the first in Alaska. Administrator Kathy Kloster says she hopes it becomes the standard.
I think there's a lot of really good people that work really, really hard in buildings that are not designed to house people long term. And I wasn't quite sure what would work best, but I'm convinced. I feel like this is where long-term care should go. It's just like this.
Kloster says she has a story to tell, and she intends to repeat it loudly and often. The strategy seems to be working. She says Providence, the company who manages the Seward facility, likes the greenhouse idea so much it's considering building something similar in Anchorage. For APRN, I'm Annie Feit.
New technology at Ketchikan General Hospital allows surgeons in Ketchikan to consult with pathologists in Washington State during surgeries. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, the hospital says the technology will reduce travel costs as well as provide improved patient care.
The computer technology allows pathologists in Bellingham, Washington, to review slides of tissues collected during a surgery in Ketchikan while the surgery is still taking place. Rochelle Britton is a histology technician at KGH, which means she prepares tissue samples for pathologists. She says KGH doesn't have a full-time on-site pathologist. Instead, the hospital ships tissue samples to a lab in Washington State for review and schedules surgeries around visits by itinerant pathologists. But with the use of telepathology, Britton says KGH surgeons can now get pathology consults in real time, even if there is no pathologist visiting at that moment.
Since we don't have an on-site pathologist, it has opened up a new set of possibilities for better patient care here in Ketchikan. So I think that I will be able to utilize it for a lot of different things, blood smears or for radiology procedures, and especially the OR cases.
Britton says it takes minutes between the time a tissue sample is removed from a patient in Ketchikan and the point when it is reviewed by a pathologist at Bellingham-based Northwest Pathology.
I would receive the piece of tissue, select a portion that needs to be reviewed by a pathologist. I cut it, put it on a glass slide, stain it, and then scan it into the scan scope. And it's been taking me about 20 minutes.
Once the pathologist has reviewed the slide, they are able to speak to a surgeon in a KGH operating room via telephone. Britton says instant access to a pathologist is particularly useful in surgeries of cancer patients.
Usually cancer is what the main concern is, you know, whether they need to take more, are the margins clean, you know, did they get all of what they needed, what they were in there concerned about.
This technology has been used for research, academic instruction, and general pathology consultations, but rarely by smaller rural hospitals where technical experts may not be readily available. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaska tribal leaders have come up with two resolutions after 3 days of meetings in Anchorage. Delise Calcote is a tribal liaison with the Alaska Intertribal Council.
We were asked in the very beginning to leave our organizations at the door, and so to meet as the tribal people. And many of the people got up and said, you know, as a tribal person, I can stand up on this, but if you want the tribal support, I have to take this issue back to our tribal council for their action.
She says two resolutions were developed on Wednesday.
Asking for an Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act fix and an ANILCA fix. The other one is pursuing what we've been doing. In 2005, resolution number 10 was passed, and the tribes of Alaska said to pursue our international protected rights where we have international status.
The tribal committee at AITC has been pursuing protected status under a 1945 United Nations treaty since 2005. Calcote says some who attended the meeting in Anchorage will continue to push for an Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act revision. They are taking the cause to the National Congress of American Indians. Another group will pursue the protection of indigenous sovereignty rights under the UN. Alaska and Hawaii were added to the UN's non-self-governing territory list in 1946. The two resolutions will be forwarded to the tribal councils for approval. About 90 people attended the summit in Anchorage.
You know, 90 people cannot make the decision for the rest of the people because that's not democratic.
Calcote says there are about 150,000 tribal members in Alaska. An electric cooperative that serves Western Alaska villages is putting up $10 million to build two shallow draft tugs and barges to haul fuel up Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta River systems. More than that, the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative is banking that increased competition in the form of an upstart bulk fuel transportation company will help to reduce diesel fuel costs in financially strapped bush communities. AVEX Mira Kohler spoke with us about the plan to contract with newcomer Vitus Marine. She said AVEX subsidiary Microgen will build the vessels.
It's actually two tugs and two barges, so it's two sets of vessels. And the estimated cost we have right now is about $10 million. And that, of course, will firm up as we move further along in the architectural process of designing them, and then get the actual quotes from the shipyards to build them.
So these tugs and barges will be able to travel a little more easily on our river systems?
The concept that we are utilizing, which is the articulated tugs and barges, means the two essentially lock together and are operated as a single unit. So that is more effective when you're navigating meandering and sometimes extremely shallow bodies of water than if you were pulling or pushing another piece of equipment, you know, waves pushing up against the bow and so forth. So by articulating them and them going as a single unit, you eliminate a lot of the problems of dealing with the sea waves and so forth that you would normally encounter with a barge.
What does this translate to cost-wise? I mean, how is this going to save bush residents money?
Well, you know, there's no guarantee that there's going to be enormous savings, but I don't know if you recall that in the fall of 2003, we became aware that Crowley Marine was buying Yukon Fuel Company. Yukon Fuel and Crowley were two active competitors in the Western Alaska fuel market. So we went from two major competitors to a single major competitor. You know, Delta Western is also in the market, but they really don't have a wide range of operation and have not been an aggressive competitor to Crowley. So our desire is to bring competition to the market. We will see some savings on our fuel because we've entered into a five-year contract with Vitus Marine to buy our fuel through them. That starts in 2011. And under that contract, the transportation cost of the fuel is marginally less than what it cost us last year for our transportation cost. So assuming that the world continues to turn in the same direction that it has been turning, one would expect to have each year's transportation costs a little higher than the year before. So we are assured that whatever that increase is, it'll be less than what we otherwise would have had through Crowley. So we'll get a modest saving there, but what we're hoping is that by having active competition in the market, that both Vitus Marine and Crowley will keep sharp pencils and will offer the best possible prices to everybody that buys fuel from them.
You have a five-year contract now. If you really feel that the increased competition will take some of the edge off the high cost of fuel?
You know, that's all we can hope for. There's been a lot of verbiage and posturing about, oh, you know, we're at the mercy of the fuel supplier and they're the reason why the cost of fuel is so high. And you know, I don't buy that, really, but I do believe that competition is good in markets such as this. I don't know how much money is being left on the table, but if there's any money left on the table, I would hope that competition will make sure that doesn't happen. I'm hopeful that Vitus Marine will be a very robust competitor to Crowley and that they'll be able to expand their fleet as time goes on and we'll be out of it in 5 years or thereabouts and we'll just let the market run its course.
Alaska Village Electric Cooperative CEO Mira Kohler. AVEC serves 53 villages all over the state. Canada just beat the Americans 2-0 to win the women's hockey gold medal at the Vancouver Olympics. Marie-Philippe Poulin scored 2 goals and Shannon Sabatos made 28 saves today before a raucous Vancouver crowd ringing cowbells and waving thousands of maple leaf flags. After Poulin's 2 first period scores, the Canadians dominated every aspect of the game, earning their 15th straight Olympic victory. Palmer native Kerry Weiland was on the U.S. team. She'll come home with a silver medal. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at PennAir.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.